From Williamsport to Punxsutawney, Shamokin to Waynesburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the future of the steel industry in western Pennsylvania looks bright following approval of the U.S. Steel Nippon Steel deal. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And as the June 30th budget deadline draws near, education and mass transit are poised to take an even bigger bite of the state budget. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Advocates of legalizing the recreational use of marijuana continue to pressure Pennsylvania lawmakers, although a bill recently passed by the State House was killed in a State Senate committee. Neighboring Ohio did legalize recreational marijuana in late 2023, and sales began in August of last year. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, there have been mixed results. Sales to date total some $540 million, but the number of accidental poisonings have increased 20-fold since legalization. Nearly 500 children have been hospitalized after ingesting THC-based products. Liz McGill resigned in 2023 from her post as president of the University of Pennsylvania after failing to say that calling for the genocide of Jews violated campus policies. She resigned in the wake of criticism over her comments, or lack thereof. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer reports that McGill was paid a bonus of $725,000 that year, in addition to her $1.4 million base salary. She continues to teach law at the university. The recent primary election was greeted with a yawn by Pennsylvania voters. Following the hefty turnout for the 2024 presidential election, the number of registered voters trekking to the polls last month declined sharply. So-called off-year elections typically draw far fewer voters than years in which there are presidential, U.S. Senate, and/or races for governor, but turnout for the 2025 primary was exceptionally low. Preliminary data shows 22% of Democrats and 18% of Republicans voted. The higher Democrat turnout was largely tied to hotly contested races for mayor in Pittsburgh and district attorney in Philadelphia. The only two statewide races were for seats on the Commonwealth and Superior Courts. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. President Donald Trump traveled to the Mon Valley last week to join with steelworkers and local officials in celebrating the U.S. Steel-Nippon Steel partnership that will keep the iconic American company headquartered in Pittsburgh while bringing billions of investment into domestic plants. Our Capital Watch crew is here with details. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. This week in the studio, we have the whole team welcoming back Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, great to be with you.
Good to be back again, David. Thank you.
And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
Great to see you. A pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. Well, it is rare, vanishingly rare, to have actual clear-cut victories, but I'm proud to say that I did experience one of those recently, and I'm going to tell you guys all about it. So I was out in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, at the U.S. Steel Irvin Works for President Trump's rally and for the conclusion of the U.S. Steel, Nippon Steel merger. You guys probably saw it on TV,
yeah,
right? We found a way through, of course, that this, you know, that this merger had been proposed, going on, what, like almost 3 years ago now, but that the Biden administration shot it down, even though this was the really the only way to keep U.S. Steel going, that the company needed the modernization dollars, it needed to upgrade its aging facilities, particularly those in the Monongahela Valley, what they call the Mon Valley Works. And so and on the campaign trail, President Trump was against it. And so going into this new year, we were not sure what was going to happen. But they found a way forward. And that the solution is kind of intriguing because it comes down to governance, really, about that this is a critical American asset because, of course, steelmaking is foundational to an industrial economy. So the way that it's going to work is that Nippon Steel is purchasing all publicly traded shares of U.S. Steel. Nippon is then giving to the federal government of the United States what they call a golden share, which means like the voting shares. And so the federal government of the U.S. is going to be a backstop that Nippon had agreed that U.S. Steel will continue to be a separate entity, although it's owned by Nippon. It's a separate entity with an American board of directors and an American CEO. So this is the backstop to make sure. And I don't think Nippon was ever interested in doing this. They just want to do business. But you have to protect against, a foreign company or a foreign interest purchasing an American company and then, winding down the U.S. operations and sending in product that was made overseas. So now we have all of those safeguards in place while also meeting Nippon's requirement that they own the company because they have proprietary technologies and production methods that they will only deploy when they own the whole thing. Because if it's a joint venture and you use those proprietary things, your partner sees what you're doing and then they can just clone it and use it on their own operations. So that's the breakthrough, that we have arranged a deal that actually works for everybody.
And this allows for those worried about national security interests to have solid peace of mind that Americans will own and control that aspect of things.
Yes, that while Nippon Steel will own the company and will earn money off of the activities here in the U.S., that the control of the company, both how it is run operationally and how it's run corporately, that will be under the control of not just Americans but also the U.S. federal government. And so – and this is what makes possible what is going to be the most amazing investment any of us have seen in our lifetimes. Because – so Nippon with the purchasing the shares, that's $14.9 billion. But of course, that goes to shareholders, and that's dispersed all across the country and probably around the world. But they're going to invest an additional $14 billion in upgrading U.S. Steel's assets, here in the United States, and that Mon Valley's not going to get all of that, but it's going to get a lot of it.
And there was no other entity out there that had the expertise and the interest and the capital to do anything like this, even remotely like this.
That's exactly right.
And the U.S. Steel production and situation was getting more and more precarious.
Yes.
And if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, the union that represents many of the workers at U.S. Steel was originally opposed to this job-saving American facility.
This is the really intriguing part where – that the union locals, the union locals that represent the people who work in the Mon Valley at the Claret and Coke Works, at the Irvin facility, at the Edgar Thomson plant, that union and those workers are for the deal. because they recognize this is the only way to save our communities, to save our facilities, to save our jobs. And but the local got sold out by the national union boss because he's an Ohio guy and he's all mobbed up with Cleveland Cliffs. And that they were looking to either buy U.S. Steel on the cheap or to see it broken up for parts. Either way, they eliminate one of their major domestic competitors. And so this is something else that's, you know, triumphant about this, almost like an underdog story where, you know, not only did the deal come back after being, you know, dispatched, discarded by Joe Biden, but also that the people whose jobs are on the line won out over the union boss, the you know, far up union boss who tried to sell them out.
What I think is just really amazing about this deal is it's not just Pennsylvania. Obviously, we're really happy about the investment, that just record-breaking investment in Pennsylvania. But they actually have promised to keep all facilities in the U.S. open.
Yes.
So all existing blast furnaces will be at full capacity for the next decade, which affects Indiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Minnesota. And what I think is amazing about it, too, is, I mean, Steve touched on national security and how this deal, you know, sort of it works from a national security perspective, but what it does is it invests in U.S. Steel from a broad perspective is how we protect our national security interests.
Yes.
So I'm just really excited about that aspect of it as sort of a national security nerd myself.
Yes.
And how, from the standpoint of investing in manufacturing, infrastructure, you know, cars, automobiles, all of the things that we need to succeed as a nation, our economy to succeed and to protect our national security, we need to invest in steel.
Yes.
And this ensures that for the next decade, we're going to have full throttle furnaces.
Yes.
That are going to be producing U.S. steel.
And that you touched on something really important there, Rebecca, which is that you look at these assets. And, of course, the Indiana facility is the Gary Works, Gary, Indiana, right there on the Illinois state line. Up in Minnesota, that's where the mines are for the iron ore up in the iron range. And the other facilities, the newer facilities, I'm not sure about Alabama, but the one in Arkansas is an electric arc furnace. And this is something that is distinct. That is steel recycling, which is great. And we need to have that. And that's a great activity. But it is a different thing from making new steel. And when you consider the national security aspect, you can't scale scrap, which is what they're recycling in electric arc furnaces, that if you are in a wartime production scenario, you need to bring new steel into the world. And to do that, you got to have the coal. You got to turn it into coke at the coke works. You've got to mine the iron ore in Minnesota, take it to the blast furnace. And that's how you make new steel. And Nippon Steel, their production method has been the blast furnaces. And so they're bringing those proprietary technologies and production methods to upgrade the Edgar Thomson plant, which is U.S. Steel's blast furnaces. Not only will it upgrade the efficiency of those blast furnaces, it will also reduce emissions to make those facilities more defensible to the regulators. And so yes, one of the critical elements there, Rebecca, is that we will be able to bring new steel into the world, which means if necessary, we can scale up production, which is a critical need in time of war. You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor. With me on the program, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation.
There's a bit of a historical irony with this whole scenario, too. When you think about history on the scale of the 20th and 21st centuries, at one time the United States, of course, was the dominant steel producer, and U.S. Steel was part of that, and Pennsylvania was part of that, and sustained for many, many decades. And we had war with the Japanese.
Yes.
World War II, and we used our American steel to win that war.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the national security feature of having, as you said, from the ground up production of steel is critical to our ability to fight wars. And we don't want to have another war. And as we've seen, winning that war convincingly against Japan became one of our strongest allies.
Yes.
And we helped them to rebuild and create this empire of steelmaking that now allows them
to come to the U.S. Yes.
And literally help us while helping themselves and helping society in general by providing a needed product at a fair price, which is what this all boils down to. There's just an amazingly sweet irony there.
Yeah. Mr. Mori, M-O-R-I, Mr. Mori, who's the number three executive at Nippon Steel, who was the fellow who oversaw this transaction here in the U.S., Mr. Mori got his MBA from the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania, the president's alma mater. That Mori-san is he speaks flawless English. He's clearly comfortable working with and around Americans. And so, that very lovely gentleman himself, proves the story that you're describing, the dynamic that you just encapsulated there. Essentially, Nippon Steel is trying to become an American company. And so this is a way for that to actually come to pass with U.S. Steel as the instrument of earnings. The steel production can go towards, U.S. domestic infrastructure projects that have made in U.S. Requirements, that it'll be free from any of the tariff obligations that the president is putting in place. And so, they will be able to fully participate in the American economy as an American firm, which is really awesome. And of course, the scale of the investment that's coming, sort of Rebecca, getting back to your point, that we don't have the total dollar figure, but for example, the hot strip mill, the Irvin Works in West Mifflin, that facility is going to be demolished, raised, and completely rebuilt. So that is going to be $1 billion just all by itself. There's also going to be a new research center, a $200 million project that's going to be in Pittsburgh, site to be determined, but it's likely to be in the Oakland neighborhood, close to Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh, so that there'll be that synergy and dynamism of the research facility and the academic institutions.
What an amazing opportunity that is for the workforce and for our universities and our academic community here in Pennsylvania too. I didn't even realize that part. I had heard 70,000 jobs, which in and of itself is just amazing, fantastic, and that doesn't even account for the ancillary jobs that are created by building this economic investment.
There's the direct jobs, the indirect jobs, and then there's the induced jobs.
Induced, yeah.
And so in terms of that number of jobs created, many tens of thousands of that will go into the just constructing the facility, doing the work to tear down the steel mill, to rebuild the hot strip mill, to do that work at the Edgar Thompson plant, at the Clairton Coke Works. But in terms of permanent jobs, I believe that the current workforce of U.S. Steel in Pennsylvania in the Mon Valley is like 11,000 workers. So not only does this transaction save those 11,000 permanent jobs, it's going to add 14,000 more permanent jobs.
And I'm old enough to remember the 1980s and the collapse, the virtual collapse of the U.S. steel industry, and especially how it impacted the Pittsburgh area. Many of my friends from college were from that area, and they would tell me about it or show me, and it was disastrous. It was prosperous little towns and villages all up and down the rivers where families lived off the production of steel. And they thrived, as you said. The resources they needed were provided by the work in those steel mills. For the last few decades, that has, in many cases, just kind of moldered. Those neighborhoods are still there. They're getting more and more decrepit. There's crime and other difficulties, infrastructure problems. But now we're seeing this resurgence with the cracker plant nearby,
in Beaver
North
County.
Of Pittsburgh, up in Beaver County, with this facility, you're going to see the opposite side of that story again, the optimistic side where people have a new shot at being successful in life who wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah.
And you can just – I can just imagine as I drive up and down those roads now what it's going to look like when new houses are being built on a grand scale.
Yeah. Yes.
And new facilities are being put in where the old ones were in many cases completely demolished, raised and demolished. As you said, they're just big vacant concrete lots, miles and miles of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I remember those days too as a kid, driving out to Three River Stadium to see the Pirates play back in their glory. And that, along the riverfront, you would see the facilities that had been shuttered and rusting away. Well, this is us turning the tide. Then brace yourself because this investment is supposed to roll out over the next 14 months.
Wow.
And I can't. It's unfathomable what the effect is going to be of that much investment roaring in and that work being begun and accelerating. It is going to be an extremely exciting time to be in Pennsylvania. And again, this is just a very hopeful thing for our future. And it was a great honor for me to get to be there at the Irvin Works, to be there with Mr. Burritt, the CEO of U.S. Steel, and Mr. Mori from Nippon, and to be there with President Trump and so many other dignitaries, and most importantly, the workers and those local union leaders whose jobs were on the line. And so, you know, God bless America. Live to see the promised land. So anyway, that's enough out of me. We're down to the end of the show. For the listeners, Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and what you do?
They can visit CommonwealthFoundation.org.
Wonderful. And Rebecca, where can people learn more about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
They can find us at PMTA.org.
Wonderful. And as ever, you can find me online at PAManufacturers.org. So from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Businesses in the private sector must make a profit, or at least not lose money, to survive. To do so requires taking steps to operate efficiently and to produce a product at a price consumers are willing to pay. Failure to do so results in the business ceasing to exist. It is different with government agencies. There is no such thing as failure to the point of extinction. As Ronald Reagan famously observed, the closest thing to eternal life on Earth is a government program. Government agencies can fail to implement efficiencies, even deliver a bad product, and still continue to exist. That happens since all government programs are created because there is a constituency for them, and that constituency cares not about cost efficiency or consumer satisfaction. They just care that the bureaucracy continues to exist. If the program becomes financially insolvent, then the deep pockets of taxpayers are raided to bail them out. With a state budget deadline of June 30th looming, we are seeing that scenario play out in many areas, but especially with public transportation and K-12 government education, which each are annually given an endless pit of taxpayer dollars while failing to reform or improve the services they are tasked with delivering. Both the Southeastern Pennsylvania Regional Transit Authority, SEPTA, and Pittsburgh Regional Transit, PRT, have turned up the heat on legislative budget makers demanding more taxpayer dollars to cover massive budget deficits. They threaten draconian service cuts and/or fare hikes if lawmakers fail to heed their demands. Both are quick to get out the tin cups, but neither have undertaken the reforms needed to improve efficiency and adjust to the changing dynamics of rider needs. If they don't get the funding they demand, then they will do what bureaucracies always do, make the most painful cuts possible. Governor Josh Shapiro and State House Democrats largely hail from urban areas serviced by public transportation. They are more than willing to divert funds from rural areas, as Governor Shapiro did last year, to keep inefficient transit agencies afloat. K-12 public education is an even bigger drain on the public treasury. Each year, billions more are directed into the public education cartel with no corresponding demands for efficiencies. Test scores reveal that the massive amounts of increased funding have yielded no corresponding increase in student performance. A prime example of protecting a failed government program is the Hold Harmless provision of public education funding. Under this provision, school districts can and do experience a significant drop in student population, but they receive no corresponding reduction in state education funding. As a result, taxpayers are pumping hundreds of millions of dollars each year into school districts that educate fewer and fewer students. Commonwealth Court 2 years ago ruled the state's education funding formula unconstitutional. What the court did not do was rule there is not enough funding, just that the distribution of the funding is unfair. The public education cartel has distorted that ruling to justify billions more in state spending on public education. What they have not done is advance any plans to improve efficiency or produce better student performance. Government school advocates are also excessively greedy. For years, efforts at giving students in the most underperforming school districts non-government school choice options have been blocked. Known as the Lifeline Scholarship Program, it would give students, almost all minority students, the opportunity to attend a non-government school and hence get a quality education their local school district is unable to provide. Governor Josh Shapiro line-item vetoed Lifeline Scholarships. This after promising state Senate Republicans he would support them, and House Democrats have opposed creation of the program at every step in the process. Given most, if not all, of those underperforming schools are in districts represented by Democrats, they are trapping their own constituents in failed schools, placing a higher priority on demands from state teacher unions. And so, once again, as the annual state budget process hits high gear, both transportation and government school advocates are seeking billions more from taxpayers to prop up their failing enterprises. Lawmakers should require significant reforms to public transit agencies and more education freedom before acceding to any of those demands. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, WEEU-AM in Reading, along with WCRO-AM in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.